Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 288 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be talking about stress tests and TEEs. These are classic things that pop up quite a bit on NBM exams. This should be a relatively short podcast because there are some just higher things I want to hit on. But this is just one of those things you can almost promise yourself. You'll find it being tested in some way, shape, or form on step 2 CQ on step 3. So I'd encourage you to pay attention to this, take good quality notes, and then go from there. And again, as a reminder, I'll be offering the comprehensive 16 and a half hour step 2 CQ course and the MBME test taking strategies course. Both of those courses hold, the MBME test taking strategies course holds on the 24th of March. And then the 16 and a half hour step 2 CQ course holds across the 25th to the 27th of March. So just 5.5 hours each day for the comprehensive 2CK course, and then it's 2.5 hours for the test taking strategies course. For the test taking strategies course, we basically have a bunch of questions that I've written, and we'll use those to review MBME test taking strategies. Again, it'll be a very systematic fashion. By the end, you should be very well versed in the classic mistakes that people make on these exams and how to avoid them, how to read questions prudently, how to not fall for MBME traps. And then for the comprehensive course, we cover everything, right? So we cover, and the comprehensive course, I would say, is useful for sure people taking step 2 CK and for sure people taking step 3. We cover peds, surgery, OB-GYN, internal medicine, neuro, psych, biostats, ethics, quality and safety, and all those things that were changed in starting in November 2020. We cover all of those in great detail. Again, I've had one iteration of the class, and the people that attended found it to be extremely helpful. So if that's something you're interested in, reach out to me, and I'll be happy to point you in the right direction. Okay, just shoot me an email through the website, and I'll give you some more details on costs and what we do. But the courses are held over Zoom. And again, for those of you that are taking the newer MBME exams, I'm telling you, it will definitely be for your best benefit. It's very thorough, very comprehensive. We cover a ton. We cover probably about 1,200 concepts across the 3 days. So, okay. So let's jump right into it, right? So let's talk about these stress tests. So the thing is, many people, I feel, unfortunately, have a warped understanding of what a stress test constitutes. The thing is, stress tests, if you divide it into two major goals you're trying to accomplish, you'll be in good shape, right? So the thing is, these stress tests, there are two major things you try to do. One, there's going to be a method of stress. And then two, there's going to be a method of imaging, right? I'll say that again. There's going to be a method of stress and there's going to be a method of imaging. The method of stress is different. The method of imaging is different. So you stress the heart to see if you can induce ischemia by performing certain maneuvers. And then you then image the heart in some way as a surrogate for all. Because it's not enough to just try to induce ischemia. You need to be able to capture that ischemia so you know that ischemia actually exists, right? So what are the methods of stress? Well, the first one is dobutamine, right? Although maybe I should talk about exercise first. Let's talk about exercise first. The thing is, an exercise-based stress test is the one you should always pick if there are no contraindications to exercise. This is the first-line method of stress. Again, the fact that it's the first-line method of stress, again, doesn't mean that, oh, an EKG must always be what you do alongside. No, okay? That's why, again, you need to parse these stress tests into two things. There's a method of stress, and there is a method of imaging, okay? So the first-line modality for stressing a person is exercise. Right? It's exercise. Many times they call this the Bruce protocol. You basically try to see if you can get to 85% of the person's target heart rate. Right? So this is what you should always go with if there are no contraindications to exercise, right? So the contraindications to exercise would be like if the person has like severe peripheral arterial disease, or the person has severe osteoarthritis, right? Or the person is like crippled, unfortunately, right? In those circumstances, those people should not exercise. And the thing is, the reason why these exercise-based methods of stress are ideal, right, is it gives you a lot of information, tells you about like what the person's exercise capacity looks like, Sometimes you can estimate the person's metabolic equivalent from that. You can also evaluate the person's like hemodynamic responses to exercise, right? So like what their heart rate can go up to with exercise, what their blood pressure can go up to with exercise, right? Now, the thing is, what constitutes a positive test with these exercise-based stress tests? Well, let's say you're doing it with an EKG. Let's just assume you're doing it with an EKG as your method of imaging. I know an EKG is not an actual image, right? But it pretty much captures the electrical activity in the heart. So the thing is, if you notice that, if they tell you in the MBME question that, oh, as a result of this exercise, you're beginning to see ST segment depressions, that's a positive test. You can go ahead and stop the study, right? The person has some kind of coronary ischemia. Now, one high-yield thing you need to know for purposes of MBME exams is before you go and use exercise as your method of stress, you need to make sure that the person is off cardiodepressive medications, right? So things like your beta blockers or your non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like verapamil and diltiazem. Those drugs, right, they depress the heart's function, right? So the whole purpose of these exercise-based stress tests is you want these people's heart rates to get to an acceptable level. If you're on a beta blocker, it may be really hard to get to those kinds of levels, right? So just a high-yield thing to keep in mind for exams. Now, the next one is dobutamine, right? Dobutamine, we know dobutamine, it's a beta-1 agonist. So again, this is the second method of stress. Dobutamine is a beta-1 agonist. By being a beta-1 agonist, right, it increases the heart rate, increases the contractility, increases the myocardial oxygen demand, right? So basically, you only do this, again, where people cannot exercise. But again, your friends at the MBME, they love to see if you know these contraindications. And for whatever bizarre reason, these contraindications don't seem to make their way to many resources, right? So the thing is, if a person has severe hypertension, right, you don't want to be giving them dobutamine. Because again, being a beta-1 agonist, it increases cardiac output, right? It increases heart rate. It increases stroke volume. So all these things, right, can raise the person's blood pressure even more. If a person's blood pressure is like 190 over 110 at baseline, and then you give them dobutamine, you're getting their blood pressure into the 200s. That's not very prudent, right? You don't want them getting like a stroke or something during the study. They'll probably be bad. And then the other one is if the person has a very nasty like tachyarrhythmia, right? If the person has like WPW, that is especially like it's symptomatic, or they have those arrhythmias at baseline, you don't want to go ahead and give those people dobutamine because again, it could worsen those arrhythmias, right? And then if a person has an acute coronary syndrome, especially unstable angina, you should also not be giving them dobutamine, right? Because again, you don't want to be increasing the myocardial oxygen demand in a person that already has, because when a person is in unstable angina territory, chances are their coronary stenosis is more than 90%, right? So you don't want to be doing that under those circumstances. Because again, if you increase myocardial oxygen demand, you can throw those people into a full-blown MI, right? Because again, remember, MIs arise from a supply-demand issue, right? So if you increase the demand, right, for blood, but there's nothing happening to the supply because the person has coronary disease, then the person can be thrown into an MI, even if they don't have like full-blown obstruction. And then another reason why you should maybe not do a dobutamine stress test, again, as your method of stress, is if the person has a cardiac condition that predisposes them to syncope, right? A cardiac condition that predisposes them to syncope. So what in the world do I mean by this? Well, think about the genetic disease, athlete collapses on the field, right? Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, those people, they shouldn't do a dobutamine-based stress test, right? And again, the newer MBMEs, right, they can give you these scenarios where you're like, wait, I thought... Because the thing is, many people think the MBME, for some reason, just invents new concepts to test. That's not really true, right? It's the same concepts that... Well, you know, the new stuff is the stuff from November 2020, which, again, I've made tons of podcasts for, right? You can all find those on the website. But really, like, another thing is just... they can give you these, like they're just finding unusual ways to test the same things that you've known before, right? So like if a person has HCM, you don't want to give them something that stresses out their heart, right? Because if their heart rates, their contractility increases, that will worsen that left ventricular outflow tract obstruction that is caused by systolic motion of the anterior mitral valve leaflet, and they can syncopize. Or if you see an older person with a history of aortic stenosis, again, you don't want to do a dobutamine-based stress test because again, those people can collapse and you know probably like die during the course of the study, and that will not be ideal. Now the next method of stress, right, is vasodilator stressing, right? So the thing is, these vasodilators, they work based on the coronary steel principle, right? So let's look at two blood vessels, right, A and B. So let's say A is 95% stenosed and B has no stenosis, right? These are both coronary arteries. Now the thing is, A, the stenosed vessel, the heart has this unique adaptation. The coronary vessels have this unique adaptation. When there's stenosis, distal to that stenosis, that coronary vessel dilates maximally, right? I mean, you can't dilate forever. If you dilate, right, you pop the vessel, which you don't want. So it dilates maximally until it hits its maximum dilation. So it's always maximally dilated, right? So that means if you give a vasodilator, it can't dilate any further. If not, the vessel will pop. But coronary vessel B, the one without stenosis, because it doesn't have any stenosis, it's not maximally dilated, so it has the ability to respond to the administration of a vasodilator. So if, for example, you administer a vasodilator, and these vasodilators can be drugs like adenosine, right, or dipyridamole, or regadenosine, right? Regadenosine is R-E-G-A-D-O-N-O-S-O-N. Remember, regadenosine is a derivative of adenosine, probably a little more expensive if I'm not mistaken. But basically, right, like these drugs, they are vasodilators. So if you give that vasodilator, well, vessel B that has no stenosis is going to dilate because a vasodilator is around as it's supposed to. But vessel A will not, right? Vessel A will not, because it's maximally dilated. It can't dilate any further, so it doesn't pop. So because vessel B is dilated, if the same fixed amount of blood is coming to those two vessels, well, some extra blood will be shunted through B, because B has more room to receive blood compared to A. So let's say normally A and B together, they have this common source artery that delivers 500 mL to artery A and 500 mL to artery B. Well, if that 1 liter of blood total comes through that source vessel, because vessel B is dilated, it may get 800 mL, and then 200 mL will go to vessel A. If 200 mL goes to vessel A, that region of the heart that vessel A supplies will then be like, I'm not seeing enough oxygen, what's going on here? It'll start freaking out, the person will have chest pain, right? The person will have ischemic symptoms, right? So that's the coronary steal principle. You're literally stealing blood from a coronary artery, because that you're stealing blood from a stenosed coronary artery, because the stenosed coronary artery has no ability to dilate. It's maximally dilated, distal to occlusion. Okay, right. So the thing is, again, adenosine, remember, it causes hyperpolarization, right? So if you hyperpolarize things, especially smooth muscles, right, they're going to relax. Remember, hyperpolarization means you're making potassium escape from the cell, right? If potassium escapes, the smooth muscle cells will relax and get vasodilation. Dipyridamole, we know that dipyridamole is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, right? Again, the reason you may see me going over some basic science details in some of these step 2 CK, step 3 targeted podcasts is that your friends at the MBME, they've gotten smart, right? Again, you know this exam is becoming, step 1 is becoming pass-fail in a few months here, right? So some of these step 1 details are slowly beginning to shift to step 2 CK and step 3. And step 3. I mean, step 3 for sure, they ask a ton of pharmacology questions. I can tell you this from experience and from tutoring tons of people that have taken said exam. So essentially, right, like dipyridamole, it's a vasodilator in one of two ways, right? So one is it's a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. So by inhibiting phosphodiesterase, right, it's going to increase your levels of cyclic AMP. And when cyclic AMP is high in smooth muscle, it causes it to relax. And when it relaxes, it dilates, okay? So you have smooth muscle relaxation with dipyridamole, right? So it's a vasodilator in that regard. So it dilates the coronary vessels. But another thing is, dipyridamole is also an adenosine deaminase inhibitor. So by inhibiting adenosine deaminase, adenosine is going to build up, right? And then you're going to get that, you know, hyperpolarization, and you're going to get that vasodilation. And then, like I said, regadenosine is an adenosine analog. So what are some reasons? What are some key things to know about these vasodilators? Well, the thing is, again, you can use them when the person cannot exercise, when exercise as the method of stress is not indicated. Now, what are some contraindications? Again, these ones are especially high yield to know for the USMLEs, right? So if the thing is, these things are very bronchoconstrictive, they are very bronchospastic. So the thing is, if a person has really bad reactive airway disease, let's say they have really bad asthma, really bad COPD, they really shouldn't be taking these medications, right? Theophylline basically antagonizes the actions of adenosine, right? So you don't want, if a person is on theophylline, then they should not be doing this particular test, or they need to stop the theophylline for a while before they do these vasodilator based stress methods, right? Remember, adenosine slows conduction down the EV node. So if a person has like really bad EV block, like a third degree EV block or Mobitz 2, for example, then they should not be getting this test, right? And remember, again, caffeine actually antagonizes the actions of adenosine. So you actually need to tell your patients to like not have coffee or tea for about a day before these adenosine based stress tests are done, right? Now, one floridly high yield thing to know that I can almost promise you probably will not find anywhere is that in general, if a person has a left bundle branch block, I'll say that again. If a person has a left bundle branch block, the method of stress that is preferred, that is first line in these people, is this vasodilator based stress testing, right? If a person has a left bundle branch block, do not give them dobutamine. Do not have them do any kind of exercise. Well, why is that? The reasoning behind that is, yeah, like the way I think of it is, dobutamine, right, activates the heart's electricity for you to get contraction and all those things. Exercise, right, your sympathetic nervous system comes into gear, activates the heart electricity, and then the heart contracts. The thing is, these because these are versus a vasodilator that just relaxes the coronary vessels. The thing is, electricity may actually skew your results because these electricity-based methods, if you may, they may actually skew your results because the thing is, you need to, again, activate the heart's electrical activity, right, with all these methods. But vasodilators, again, they are less dependent on the heart's electrical activity. Because if a person has a left bundle branch block, remember, it may take some time for the signals to be translated from the left atrium to the left ventricle, right? Or from the AV nodes to the left ventricle. So because there is a delay in signal transmission, it may lead you to believe that a certain region of the heart is ischemic when it's not. Where it's just like, you know what, the signal is still coming through. It's just taking a long while to come through. So if you see a person that has a left bundle branch block, you want to pick a method of stress that involves adenosine or dipyridamole or regadenosine, right? And then what are the methods of imaging? This one should be a much easier discussion. EKG, right, is a classic one that's used. But again, if a person has a baseline abnormality in the EKG, right, let's say they have like a left bundle branch block, or they have like left ventricular hypertrophy, right, or they have like some kind of ST depression at baseline, then it can make your studies very non-diagnostic, right? So if a person has a baseline EKG abnormality, don't select an EKG-based stress test. The next one that can be used as the method of imaging is an echocardiogram, right? Again, if a person has a baseline EKG abnormality, you can do an echo-based stress test. The thing is, if you're trying to evaluate for like valvular data, or you're trying to evaluate for wall motion abnormalities, then classically on NVM exams, an echo is a pretty great idea to use in those circumstances. And then the third thing is a nuclear medicine-based test, right? So usually on NVM exams, they can call this a thallium, T-H-A-L-L-I-U-M, thallium scintigraphy, right? So this one is great, right? Basically, if you see like a radionuclide mentioned in the Q-STEM or in an answer choice, it's the nuclear medicine-based stress test. So what are some contraindications to this? Well, if the person should not be getting radiation exposure, because you're literally getting radiation, although it's extremely minimal, it's pretty much safe. So like if a person is pregnant and they're getting a stress test, you know, it should not be this one, right? Or if a kid is getting a stress test, it should probably not be this one either, right? And also, if a person has like very large breasts, right, like a lot of breast tissue, they should also not be getting this particular stress test, right? Because again, that can cause a lot of artifacts. That's one thing that is a pain in radiology, right? And they test it a lot on radiology boards, just different artifacts, how you minimize them and all those things. But this is not a radiology podcast. So last thing I will just say here is, many people, I've had this question from many students, like, Divine, when do I choose TEE as the answer on NVM exams? when do I choose TEE as the answer in NBIM exams? Because, you know, TEE, transesophageal echocardiography, is different from TTE, transthoracic echocardiography. Obviously, TEE is better because, you know, you put the ultrasound probe in the esophagus, and the esophagus is like really put just behind the left atrium, so you get much better views of the heart. It's a little more sensitive in those respects. So let me tell you this. There are four scenarios on NBIM exams where you always go to TEE over a TTE. Okay, and sometimes your friends at the NBIM, they will put both as answer choices just to mess with your head. Pick the TEE. So let me explain. The first one is if the person has endocarditis. If a person has endocarditis and you're trying to pick an echocardiographic method, always go to TEE. Second one, if the person you suspect they have a thrombus in the left atrium, right? It doesn't matter. Always go to TEE. I mean, literally, you're putting the ultrasound probe in a region of the body, the esophagus, that's why it's called transesophageal echocardiography, that is right posterior to the, it's like really right behind the left atrium, right? So you get much better imaging that way, right? And then the next one is if the person has like some kind of prosthetic valve, anything, right? If you ever worry that, oh, this prosthetic valve this person has is not working right, just always do a TEE. It's the best modality in those circumstances. And then the last one is if a person has like really bad aortic disease, right? So let's say like aortic dissection. Remember, when people have aortic dissection and they're hemodynamically unstable, typically the smart thing to do for those folks is actually to go ahead and do a TEE, right? So the mnemonic I remember is I use the term ELPA, E-L-P-A, right? So E for endocarditis, L for left atrial thrombus, P for prosthetic valve issues, and then A for aortic disease, especially aortic dissection, right? Especially aortic dissection. So I think if you know these things, you should be able to get these TEE and stress test questions right. So as I wrap up, please don't forget to subscribe to the YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. That's where I post my videos. Although the slides, you find them on the website under the respective episode number. And then for people that are, if you want to get a notification whenever I make a new podcast, just subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com. And then I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify. Although it's going to be the most recent 150. It's a WordPress role. It's something that sadly I have like literally zero control over. So if you want like the older podcasts from episodes like one, I mean, I guess if this is episode 288, if I'm doing my math right, that means episodes 1 through 138 probably won't show up on Apple Podcasts, for example, right? So if you want all the other podcasts, just go on the website. They're all there. They all, you know, God willing, be there. And they're all free. Again, you don't have to pay to download any of my podcasts. They're all free, even all the way to episode one. Okay, and the last thing I'll also say is, you know, if you need one-on-one tutoring for these exams, step one, step two CK, step three, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams, if you're a medicine resident, I need tutoring for the ABIM medicine boards or the medicine in training exam, I do offer tutoring for those. Again, I've worked with people that have had very, very, very low scores, very low practice test scores starting out. And I've worked, in some cases, I've worked with people for like 2 weeks and they've bumped up by like 30 points. So again, if you're interested in any of those tutoring, feel free to reach out to me. And also if you need help with your applications, like consulting with your applications, like ERAS applications, med school applications, I'd be more than happy to point you in the right direction. Again, I've been on an admissions committee for a year, and I've also worked with tons of people that, again, had very tricky applications, but now are residents and now medical students. So I have a lot of experience with this, what admissions committees are looking for, how to present yourself, even if you failed a USMLE exam or failed it multiple times or have like limited research, things like that, or you had to take breaks in your education. Again, I've dealt with many of those scenarios. So again, I'll be more than happy to help you in those circumstances. Now, quickly, the life lesson I just want to share today is the importance of working in your area of gifting, right? The importance of working in your area of gifting. This is actually something that I've learned quite a bit from my church. Many people, you see them, they see someone that's really successful at something, and they just jump right into it. They're like, the fact that this person has been successful, boom, that means I can be successful in this thing as well, right? Again, I have this very strong belief that everyone has a niche. Everyone has a path that's carved out specifically for them. So when you begin to work in areas that are not your areas of gifting, it's almost like you're trying to fit a round peg in a square hole, right? Or a square peg in a round hole, whichever way it goes. So just encourage you to be careful with that. You can learn from people, but don't copy them, right? You can learn from people, but don't copy them. That's one very important thing. I think even in the Bible, Jesus says, learn from me. He did not say copy me. I think that's something that many people lose sight of in this day and age. Once people see that, a person is a TikTok sensation, or a person does this, or a person does that, they immediately want to become like that person. Again, learn from people, but don't copy them, right? The thing is, you're your own unique person. And this is one thing that, unfortunately, because as you know, as you've noticed, for many of these life lessons, I love to circle back to med students and residents and people in healthcare, right? You see some people, they see like this person that seems to be really good at their job. Oh, wow, they're amazing surgeons. Oh, they're amazing radiologists. Like, they're just crushing it, whatever. And then they'd be like, you know what? Radiology must be my calling. But they don't have any aptitude for it. It's not something that they really love, right? You need to be careful, right? Or you see some people, they see their friends doing this Anki deck. They're like, wow, this Anki deck that has 2 million cards. Again, many people think I have something against Anki. No, Anki is actually amazing. It's one of the best things known to man. But again, it's not something that works for everybody, right? But people see that, a person did Anki and they got a 270 or a 280 on step 1 or step 2 CK. So that means I must do Anki to get a 270, 280 on step 2 CK or step 1. No, you don't have to do that. I'll just tell you the truth. You really don't have to do that, right? Again, even the Bible says that people that compare themselves with themselves, it's like a famous scripture, you can look it up. Comparing themselves with themselves are not wise, right? You see many people, they just like to make these comparisons. Well, maybe one thing that may be more useful to learn from that Anki person is, wow, did he do something unique? Was there something about their study process that made them succeed? Like, I remember when I was studying for the MCAT back in the day, this was like probably like 2013 or 2012. I remember, you know, there was this person that was a mentor of mine, crushed the exam, right? So I asked him, like, what study methods did you use? What study techniques did you use? What study resources did you use? Did I use many of the study resources that he used? No. But did I use many of the study approaches that he used? Yes. Did it work for me? It did, right? So the thing is, in this case, I didn't copy him word for word what he did. I learned from what he did, right? And executed, and thankfully was successful. Same thing with step one, right? Again, you see many people like, this huge ass Anki deck, you know, is the key to a 280. No, you don't. Again, there are people. Again, I can tell you from personal experience and from experience of people that I've worked with, you don't always have to. You can do Anki and get in the 270s, 280s. That's not what I'm saying, right? But there are many other things you can do. There are some people that don't touch the famous Q-banks that people know, and they still crush the exam. There are some people that don't touch any Q-bank at all and just do just the MBME assessments, and they crush the exam. That's why many times when I tutor people, I like to hold like an introductory meeting for like an hour where we just... I ask them many questions and I figure out like, okay, what will work best for you? What works best for another person? What made a person get a 270 using Anki? May not be the same thing that will make you get a 270. You could maybe get a 270 using a completely different resource that is off the beaten path. Obviously, you should use like a well-established resource. But again, just be mindful of that. Stop copying other people. Be unique in your own way, right? Be unique in your own way. You may be passing across the same information, but maybe you can pass it across in a different modality, in a different way, right? So again, just be unique. Learn from people, but don't copy them, right? Because again, you have a certain grace, you have a certain niche, right, that other people don't have, right? I just want to tell you this because some people are really down. I don't know if this is maybe a word of encouragement for someone. Some people are really down on themselves. The thing is, you're unique. Even if there are, what, like 7 billion people in this world, even if you're from a very poor family, even if you're from a place of the world where people say, wow, nothing good can come out of this place. Let me tell you this, you're unique. You're special in your own way, right? I mean, the Bible talks about how people say, oh, can anything good come out of Nazareth, right? But hey, it's Jesus they were referring to. Well, Jesus came from Nazareth, right? Or you see this Bible verse that says that there's this treasure in earthen vessels, right? So that earthen vessel is you, right? There's treasure inside you. You just have to find where your niche area is, where your area of gifting is, and then begin to use it to shine and be a star in the world that surrounds you, right? So again, don't feel like, wow, you're stupid, or maybe you have some genetic disease, or you have like some disability that because of that, you're like the worst person in the world and you have no future. No, you have a future. There are bright things about your life, right? There are things that are unique about you that no other person has, right? I mean, like I watched this movie yesterday for Valentine's Day, Forrest Gump. And I mean, the guy, you know, was he perfect in every way? No, right? But hey, he could run. He could run. And, you know, he may not have been perfect in every way, but that running got him to college, made him meet the president, what, like, maybe like twice, and all those things, right? So, like, just be mindful of that. When you're down on yourself, feeling like a failure, remember there is something special and unique about you. So I'm going to go ahead and pause here. We'll see you in the next podcast. I hope you have a wonderful week, and God bless you. I'll see you next time. Thank you.